The following is a true story, except for the ending, which just hasn't happened yet. This is Escape from Provo Canyon.
So a week has passed, and it's time to get off this couch. And at Provo, like at so many penal institutions, like toughness is valued and weakness is punished. So, you know, you want to assert your dominance. And at Provo, you do that by going to the biggest, the meanest 16-year-old truant, and you challenge him to a game of Candyland. Candyland is one of those board games where you, like, draw cards and move your pieces around the board in the hopes of reaching the Candyland Castle. Hasbro says it's for, like, 3 to 6-year-olds, but today on the couch, you know, we're 4 hardened 17-year-old Provo inmates. This is competitive Candyland. All of a sudden, the board just explodes into the air, you know, pieces and cards flying everywhere, accusations of cheating.
What are you doing on a rainbow trail?
I'm always on the rainbow.
Putting your ass down in the molasses.
And a tussle breaks out. So I'm knocked to the ground, you know, tangled up with the guys, and the goon dude rushes over, and he's like horny. Like, he's aroused. Like, the dude, he lives for this shit. Like, as opposed to when, you know, we were in his office, and he gave me my number, and I started to cry. Like, that part of his job, like, he hates, you know, like, wet nose, little crybaby. But yeah, when a fight over Candyland breaks out, he's, like, fully up for it. So with the help of, like, a couple goons, you know, he rips all the dudes apart, you know, me included. You know, the combatants are subdued. And in me, I'm just getting off the floor because I was knocked over. You know, that was it. And the goon dude says to the goon, he's like, 142 and 139, like 10 ips each. And then he looks at me and he's all like, 196, 10 ips as well. The goon grabs my arm and he's like, let's go. And I'm like, what? Like, where are we going? And he's like, come on, we're going to investment. You know, you got 10 ips, you got to stand them off. And I'm like, I'm lost. I have no idea what he's saying. And then one of the guys looks over at me and he's just all, yeah, you just popped your cherry, dude.
So I got ips. Yeah, and I know what you're thinking. It's like, no, ips are not a venereal disease. Ips is Provo's acronym for, like, investment points. And investment points are, you know what, fuck it. I'm gonna let someone else take this. Alice. Hey, Alice.
Investment points is a points-based disciplinary system used by Provo to punish students for offences, such as tardiness to line up, talking back, swearing, and other sundry offences. Guilty students are immediately removed to investment, a dedicated room where students serve investment points by standing and staring at a wall. 30 minutes standing works off 5 investment points. While standing, students must observe structure in increments of 30 minutes. Observing structure, namely standing erect, shoulders back, hands clasped behind the back, nose 6 inches from the wall. No fidgeting or swaying, no talking, no making contact, eye, physical or otherwise, with other students and or staff. Breaking structure can result in additional investment points. Investment points are assigned at the discretion of supervising staff. There are no set sentencing guides. However, by way of example, an innocent slip of the tongue swearing.
Ah, shit.
That might result in 5 investment points, which often leads to an expression of resentment.
God damn it.
The additional swearing raises the investment points to 10, which may lead to a petulant taunting. You call that swearing? Cock-sucking motherfucking two-old bitch. The additional swearing is compounded with talking back, resulting in a doubling of investment points, bringing the total to 30. 10 investment points.
Fuck.
Talking back 20 investment points. At this point, student indignation reaches a point of maximum frustration.
Get your hands off me.
This can lead to staff physically restraining the student, which can escalate, thus necessitating additional resources to physically restrain the student.
Alice, well done.
So this entire ordeal has left me, like, scared, like, shitless. Literally. Like, I haven't taken a shit in 4 days. But, yeah, today's the day. So I go up to a goon and I ask him, hey, can I go to the bathroom? And he says yes, and he lets me in. And then he closes the door. Now, the bathroom, it's like one place where you can at least be by yourself for a second. You know, you go into a stall, you know, you don't see anyone. The kids are out there. And you're in there, you know, just by yourself. And it's nice. It's like a little place of like solace where you can just think, you know, and do your business. So like taking a shit or pretending to take a shit is like one of the things I actually look forward to. You know, sit in a stall by myself with my own thoughts and be with my old self. Because I knew once I'd go back out into the room, I'd be confronted with my new self, which like I didn't really understand. And at that point, all I knew was like it was a bad new Jow. So I'm sitting there. I hear the door open and I'm thinking, oh shit, it's the goon because I've probably taken too long. But instead, all of a sudden, you know, a head pops up and it's the John Gruden guy with the percussive slong. And he looks down at me. He's got this like Texan draw and he's like, someone likes a real clean asshole. And I'm like, you know, God, what is it with this guy? And it turns out, like, this is Tommy from Texas. And one of the things he's wondering, he's like, oh, hey, you court order? And I'm like, I don't know what that means. And so, you know, he schools me.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? When you were 8 and you had bad.
So there's two types of students in Provo. You got your court orders. Those are the kids who got in trouble with the law and have been like sentenced by like a judge, who through the mercy of his office, you know, offers the kids a choice, you know, serve a sentence out in juvenile hall or, you know, at a private school like Provo, nestled in the mountains of Utah. And then there's the kids like me who, despite, you know, not having had a scrape with the law, are blessed, you know, with parents willing to pay to have their kids sent to Provo. So there's a bit of a divide, you know. Court orders, they're typically more gnarly, kind of hardened teenagers. You know, they've broken the law and they've gotten caught by the police and sentenced by judges, you know, and perhaps multiple times. And then there's the rest of us, you know, whose rambunctious exploits, you know, have pried open the wallets of their parents, you know, to, in effect, outsource their parenting to Provo Canyon.
You know, my kids get in the way of my life. Let me just drop them off. Yeah, and it's like, no need to drop off. Like, we'll come and get them, you know? And you've all heard what that's like.
And so newbies like me enter the institution of Provo Canyon through intake, which is designed to sort of, you know, break the spirit, to disassociate from the old self, and to conform, you know, to the Provo way. And after intake, there's like 6 other units where kids who demonstrate like a will to reform, they can move out to and earn like increasing privileges. And this whole unit system, it culminates with one outer unit called Hotel. And this is where kids who have like completely gone with the program, they're able to live off campus, or rather off compound, in a hotel owned and operated by the school. You know, a kid might run the laundry service or even the reception desk over there. And wages are saved up as there's nothing to purchase except on Fridays. And they can use their savings to buy a pizza.
Pizza, pizza party.
Now, the antipod to this, like, Hotel Shangri-La is a unit that's, like, deep in the bowels of Provo. This unit, it houses, like, the incorrigibles, you know. The kids have, like, the strongest spirit and will, but, you know, whose continued clashes with the staff just rack up like an endless cycle of ips. You know, these are the lowest of the low, you know, the true wretches of Provo. And this unit is called Long Term.
So anyways, Tommy, you know, he becomes, like, my first friend. You know, we hang out on the couch and goof, like, on the silent soap actors on TV. make up dialogue, like something lewd enough to be funny, but yet not so crass as to merit like an Ip sentence. On the fourth day, the army goon hauls in this Asian punk. And he had like this glorious peroxide-dyed mohawk, like that guy Rufio in the movie Hook. And the army goon, he takes him back in the office where you know he's getting the speech and his number. And then when the two come out, army goon sits the dude in a chair, and behind him is a goon who holds him in place by the shoulders. And the fucking dick, like, he just runs a razor right down the center of the kid's fucking scalp. And there's all this hair falling around the dude's ankles, and, you know, he just starts sobbing. And in an instant, you know, he's just fucking shorn. Like, his whole punk rock identity is swept up off the floor and dumped in a trash can.
I mean, he's a fucking punk rock kid, you know? I mean, like, hair is everything, you know? Like, hair is your identity. Hair's maybe what got you in here in the first place. Like, I don't know. But yeah. And the fucking main goon dude, like, he fucking does him dirty, and he does it like this in front of all of us, like, conspicuously, to reinforce the psychology that, like, you know, I'm in charge of all you fucks.
So later on, you know, I'm trying to console this kid. You know, I'm like, hey, you know, fucking shit happens to everybody. You know, Tommy here, he had his fucking hair down to his ass before the grimace did him. And Tommy's like, wait, what? Who? And I'm like, the grimace. And they're both like, what? So this goon dude, like, he's no longer like army cut in the photo in his office. Like, the guy's pretty much hung his body up in the closet. Like, since then, he's devolved into this strange, like, tear-shaped being. Like his head is like a pinhead that melts into chins and cascades onto his shoulders. Like there is no neck. And he wears this, like, tent-sized, like, Ralph Lauren purple polo that, like, drapes over his, like, sloping body. So, you know, I nicknamed him the Grimace. And I could tell, like, Tommy and Rufus, like, they aren't getting it. And I'm like, guys, like, you remember Ronald McDonald Gang, you know, like, the Hamburglar, Mary McCheese. I'm like, he's the Grimace.
One day, Ronald and his friend spotted evil Grimace running off with loads of shakes and
crumbs. Ah, tasty.
And they're like, oh, yeah. So I was able to put a smile on Rufio's face. And from then on, like we'd say it, like, openly. But the Grimace, he could never figure out what we were laughing about. And it's like this little, you know, act of subversion, you know, that we all get a share in, which is totally cool because it's like my first little win. It's like, oh, Jal came up with a nickname. He's the Grimace. So yeah, from couch to Cafe Cynique, back to couch, you know, days turn into a week and then another week. And I just settle into this routine of, like, doing absolutely nothing.
Tedium. Pure tedium. That's Provo's weapon of choice. Provo's poison pill to curb impulses and dull sharp edges. It's as if, by inflicting tedium, Provo castrates the id, leaving the ego gelded and supine, in the hopes that a new superego will emerge, that is pliable and in service to Provo's institutional society.
Never thought about it that way, Alice. You know, the day you cease to resist is the day you're ready.
After about 3 weeks, Tim Tubb shows up, and back in his little office, he tells me that, hey, Jeff, since you've been such a good little egg, I'm moving you out of intake, out to Unit 1, and you'll start school on Monday.
So that morning, I'm escorted out of intake to my new unit. Unit 1. A goon opens the door and I immediately have to shield my eyes. Because against the far wall is a large window through which streams in the sun.
And, like, this is the first time I've seen natural light in, like, fucking 3 weeks.
Unit 1 is about the same size as intake, only a little nicer. You know, there's a pool table, kids with Walkmans. But as opposed to intake, where the bunks are just sort of lined up against the wall, Unit 1 has these little alcoves that house maybe 4 or 6 bunks each, so offering a little bit of privacy.
And on my new bunk, there's a bag, and it's filled with my clothes. My favorite thrift shop shirt. I used to wear lots of like collared shirts, you know, kind of like 50s style, sort of like what maybe like Potsy would wear on Happy Days. I don't know. It was the cool thing to wear, you know, like thrift shop clothes back then. But on the collar, like, what do I see? It's like written in Sharpie is the number 196. Like, poof. Like someone had written that in with a Sharpie. And it turns out that was like Provo's way of identifying my stuff for laundry. But yeah, I mean, it feels like an invasion of privacy. I mean, you know, like your hair, your clothes make up, you know, a lot of your identity. And here all of a sudden, poof, you know, there's a stamp, you know, a Provo stamp reminding you, you know, you're 196. You're not New Wave Jow and thrift shop shirt, you know, you're 196. And I always consider this like stupidly missed opportunity. Like, why the hell weren't we all in uniform? I mean, maybe not like orange jumpsuits, but, you know, something, I don't know. You know, but it was nice to have my old look back. I'm introduced to Unit 1's like resident goon. Who's this big fucker? I mean, they're all big, like beefy BYU beefcakes. Later on, I find out most of these guys come from Brigham Young University's like varsity offensive line. But yeah, he schools me on some of the new rules. Like, you know, when you make your bed, the sheets have to be just so like a quarter can bounce off of them. I have a little closet where, you know, I need to organize my shirts, like collar to t-shirt, you know, dark to light, hanger space, you know, 1 inch apart.
Keep them separated.
I mean, there's like a rule or a protocol for everything. And you had to learn this shit fast. And you learned it by screwing up and getting ips. And, you know, you get busted for an infraction, you know, maybe, you know, the hangers were, you know, 3/4 of an inch apart. And it was always 5 ips, which is like just a half hour, so it's not a big deal. So one day I get sent down to investment for some infraction, but my goon, like, he fails to tell me which one. And so I stand my half hour, and on returning to Unit 1, there's a new goon. The old guy, you know, his shift ended. So I asked that guy, hey, what did I do? Only he doesn't know because he's just starting his shift and wasn't there. So I never find out what I've done. So I meet some of my new peers, you know, a wily bunch. And it's always the same. It's like, hey, you know, my name's Joe. I'm from Saratoga, the Bay Area. And it's like so many prison stories. Like everyone's like, oh, what did you do? You court order? And like admitting to going open kimono in Palo Alto, like, that makes me feel like a dupe. Like, I'm tended to make up something, like, super hardcore. You're like, yeah, man, like, I scarred Saratoga High's quad doing donuts in my bitchin' Camaro. But, like, in the end, I tell them the truth. It's like, I didn't do anything anybody else wasn't doing. And although that doesn't command, like, massive respect, like, it does forge a bond of sorts, you know? I mean, like most inmates, you know, hey, man, everybody's innocent. There was this one, like, red-haired dude from Los Angeles. He claimed his dad was in the movie business or something. And the guy had, like, way too much energy. Like, I could totally see him being, like, a cokehead. And it was as if he still had some blow, like, coursing through his system. But he did this thing, like, he'd always stop me and then, like, bust into this Elvis version of Tutti Frutti. You know, he'd be like, Tutti Frutti, all Rudy. Tutti Frutti, all Rudy. Wop, bomba, doodle, bing, bang, boom. And then he'd like knock his knees together and strike this fucking pose. And I'd be like, right on, dude. And then that was it. There's another guy, James, thoughtful, soft-spoken. The poor guy had a deformity on the left side of his face. Like it was as if, you know, it was made of wax and had melted, like, I don't know, maybe a stroke or something. But yeah, James was a real head, like smoked a lot of weed, took a lot of psychedelics, into prog rock, loved Rush, tried on many, many occasions to, you know, to open my eyes to the brilliance of Neil Peart. And that would get my back up, you know, and I'd start defending Stuart Copeland, you know, like, he's the master. Like, how could you say that, you know? And we'd devolve into like a pair of like rabbinical school dropouts, you know, like arguing like the Talmud of like 1980s drumming. So fucking stupid. And then there's this dude from Laguna Beach. I forget his name, but let's just call him Chet. Like, he's the quintessential antagonist that you see in those 80s films, like some blonde ski instructor with like a pastel sweater tied around his neck who's like a total dick and like trying to steal your girlfriend. And Chet always makes sure to show me this framed picture of him behind the wheel of some, you know, some bitchin' convertible Beamer that he insists is his, which means it probably isn't.
You know, Chet's kind of a pain in the ass, but, you know, a fellow Californian. My new bunkmate is this heavy metal dude. Like, not a court order, but from somewhere in the South, like one of the Carolinas or something. He lets me check out his tapes, and I'm flipping through all of this, like, Southern Fried Rock, you know, like Charlie Daniels Band, like Molly Hatchet, Kansas. And then I run into, like, a bunch of Ingvar Malmsteen. And I'm like, dude, you've got, like, Ingvar's complete discography. And he tells me, he's like, yeah, man, I fucking love Ingvar. You know, because he's, like, technically perfect. I'm like, yeah, right on. So I keep flipping through the tapes, and it's Ingvar, Ingvar, Ingvar. And then all of a sudden, it's like, Paganini, Paganini, Paganini. And I'm like, I know who Paganini is. Like, my dad loved Paganini. So I'm like, dude, what are you doing with Paganini? And he's all, dude, like, Paganini shreds like Ingvar. Like, he's that good. And I'm like, yeah, but Paganini's classical. And he's like, yeah, I know. And Ingvar is heavy metal, so they both shred. That's all that matters. And I'm like, right on, dude. And the guy turns out to be somewhat of an intellectual. And, you know, we become good friends. And I never thought I'd have something in common with a guy, you know, like him. And, like, I think of myself as, like, New Waver Jow from Saratoga, California, you know? I'm into skating, you know, playing drums, David Bowie, and The Police. And this guy, you know, he's some metal dude from, like, South Carolina. But he's totally cool, you know, and we're good friends. So, Monday rolls around. Turns out it's not Provo Canyon Stalag. It's actually Provo Canyon School. Like, this place does have a school. And so our unit is marched down like a series of those like creep show hallways into an auditorium where there's a bunch of other kids from other units. And so we all call off our numbers and then we're escorted into the school area, which is nothing more than just another creep show hallway, but this time with about maybe 8 classrooms. I have biology with Rufio. Rufio's not the greatest student. I like to think I try to help him get by. We do team up for this one rad project where we get to draw this diagram of a cell on a large poster board. And when we turn the cilia, which are like the little hairs on the outside of the membrane, like we turn those into a mohawk. And we give them a name. It's like Spike, the punk rock cell. It's our little way to sort of rebel. And Rufio, in a way, gets his mohawk back. I have French with the Mormon guy who had spent time in Europe on his mission. Dude speaks like 5 languages. He's cool. I have mathematics, which is just like completely fucking remedial. But I do get to do a lot of dreaming in there about Daphne. So yeah, right before math, I had this Greek mythology class, and I fucking love this class. It's like, the teacher's all right, you know? All I gotta do is just sit there and listen to him, like, recant these fucking rad Greek myths, you know? And for, like, fleeting moments, like, I'm no longer, like, the new Shitty Joe. Trapped in Provo Canyon, like, I'm Apollo, like, chasing Daphne through some fresh mountain spring. And yeah, it's like an escape of sorts, but, you know, when the bell rings and out in the hallway, like, guess who fucking pulls me aside? Wop, bomba, doo, da, da, bing, bang, boom. Yeah, right on, bro.
So, it's Saturday. Our resident goon, you know, he calls out, line up!
Line up!
You know, but instead of lining up to the door that leads out into the hallway to the school area, we line up at the door with the big glass window. It's like, dude, we're going outside. Like, this will be my first time outside in over a month.
And so, yeah, we all call off. And just as the goon is, like, opening the door, like, we hear it. And it's this voice over his walkie-talkie and these speakers that are up above the door. It's like,
senior staff dial 9.
And the goon, like, holds out his arm and, like, sweeps us back in, and he, like, locks the door. And we see, like, 3 goons, like, flash down the hallway, you know, like, walkie-talkie squawking. Our goon has us all go back to our bunks, where we wait, you know?
And by now, like I know what senior staff dial 9 is. That's like goon code for like an acute situation that needs staff attention, which like in most cases it's like a kid freaking out or maybe two dudes beefing, you know. But you know, kids need to be restrained, you know. So call in the troops, which is pretty commonplace. But judging by today's commotion, like this is something else. This is an escape.
And me, I'm all stoked. I'm like, yay, brother, fly, be free. But the rest of the guys, they're all sort of on edge, like kind of somber. And I'm like, what? I'm like, I don't get it. And fucking Chet, he's all, hey, man, you watch. Like, the Grimace, he's going to have him back here in solitary within an hour. And I'm like, really? Like, who knows? Maybe this kid's fast. Like, I don't know. And then Chet lets me in on a poorly kept secret. The Grimace, like, he's got a protocol.
So, like, in the super rare occasion when a kid escapes, like, the Grimace first ascertains, like, the last time anyone saw him, which is never longer than, like, 20 minutes, 45 tops. I mean, we're just constantly under supervision. And so, time elapsed since last sighting a kid times average speed of kid gives the Grimace a circumference. And so he pulls out his protractor, draws a little ring with Provo in the center, and he sends out the goons, you know, to man checkpoints at locations such as, like, you know, bus stops, highway on-ramps, like any place a kid could catch a ride. And so now, like, you know, his map of Utah with all these military markings, like, starts to make sense. And so the goon squad's out there, you know, drawing their dragnet in towards the center, and the noose tightens until, you know, like, sure enough, like, 15 minutes later, a new alert broadcasts, you know, informing the staff, like, in goon code, that the kid's being processed, which basically means, you know, he's been caught and he's being thrown in observation. Now, imagine, like, a shittier place than the bowels of Provo. Observation is it. Like, past intake, past long-term, there's a dark, long hallway, and at the end of that, you'll find these two padded cells. And that's observation. And like, this is where the Grimace deposits, you know, rowdy kids, you know, whose boots need cooling. But, yeah, if you're an escapee, that becomes your new address. So back in Unit 1, you know, we hear the goon code broadcast like the all clear signal. And our goon has his line up again and call off again. And then he opens the door. And for the first time in over a month, I walk outside.
The unit's allowed to wander around inside like a fenced-in yard, and a locked gate separates us from a larger, like, snow-covered field that's ringed with a tall chain-link fence topped with, what's that called? It's like razor or like Constantiner wire. And so, yeah, the guys from Unit 1 just sort of are moping around, and no one's really saying anything. It's as if this kid's escape has cast a pall over the unit. And me, like, I'm still winding down for the excitement. Like maybe this kid, maybe he was just too slow, like, too stupid, or just, like, unlucky. And then I think, like, what if it was me, you know? Maybe I could be fast, you know, or clever, or just lucky. And then I look off into the distance, and I see these big, big mountains. And I immediately think, like, ciao, like, like, you want to get out of here? Like, you want to go over those? That's the fucking Rockies, you know? And the other way, you know, it's like the desert. Like, you are Ivan Desenovich, and this is your Siberian fucking gulag. Like, you're not going anywhere.
Stop. sorry heart with your favorite finger. Paint the whole world blue and stop your tears from stinging.
So I get a B+ on my midterm in Greek mythology, and I could have squeaked like an A-, but I kind of messed up the essay, which was on Sisyphus, and in particular, like what the dude did to piss off Zeus. And I wrote that he had sex with like some god's girlfriend, you know, like a mortal having sex with a goddess, like, you know, all of Olympus is up in arms, which forces Zeus's hands, and like I don't know, like, to be honest, like, I'm sort of riffing it, you know? And so anyways, turns out like Sisyphus revealed the location of Zeus's daughter, Aegina, to some river god, like Asopus or something, who got to have the sex. Like, not Sisyphus, but still, like, Zeus is fucking big time pissed at Sisyphus. And so he's like, you know, from now until eternity, you're going to roll this big boulder up this gnarly hill. And right as you get to the top, the boulder's going to roll back down to the bottom, and you got to start all over again, and you got to do that for fucking eternity. Ha ha! Sucks to be you, Sisyphus. And so, like, my teacher, like, he turns me on to Camus, who did a riff on all this, the myth of Sisyphus. Way better than my crappy riff. But in Camus' take, like, Sisyphus, like, he's the craftiest of the crafty. Like Sisyphus gets even with Zeus. Like, he goes beyond, like, just maybe, like, accepting his fate. Like the dude learns to love it. Like he totally gets into, like, the boulder and the slope and every little bump along the way. And like, rather than punishment, like, the dude finds meaning in the task. And which is totally fucking right on, you know? I mean, like, what are you going to do, you know? It's like fucking Zeus in eternity. He has no choice. And so from, like, that day forward, like, I slowly adopt, like, that mindset, you know? And start trying to apply it to my plight at Provo. So now it's like 3 months later, and I've moved up through unit 2 into unit 3, and, like, you know, quarters are bouncing like 3 feet off my bed, you know, if I had any. You know, my closet, it's fucking tight, you know, light to dark, 2 inches apart. You know, I'm going with the program. I stay out of trouble for the most part, but still, you know, I'm bored out of my mind, you know, anything to pass the time. Tommy Rufio and I, like, we start playing this game. We call it, like, the circle game. It's like that thing where you make a circle with your finger somewhere in your body, and if you coax somebody to look at it, you get to punch them. But if they plug the circle with their finger, they get to punch you. And so, yeah, Weez and I, we served some ips for, like, roughhousing. Nothing major, but, like, the game went viral throughout all the units until one day in the auditorium, like, before school, the Grimace comes in and makes an announcement, like a decree. Your little circle game, that's now verboten. Caught playing the circle game and you're busted down to long term. The fucking Grimace, man, he just relished quashing the fun. Having a parade? I am the rain. Just a fucking dick. Everybody hated him for that. But all of us, you know, we were on to the next thing. Always searching for those little ways to be subversive. You know, like on Friday nights, what's your snack time in the Café Cynique? You know, each kid gets an allowance, like either from the state if you're a court order, or maybe from your parents, you know, if you're not, which you can use to buy candy at this little kiosk. And then, of course, it's like, hey, Tommy, I dare you to chase 2 packs of Pop Rocks with a Pepsi. And it's like, oh, yeah, watch me. And, of course, he ends up frothing all over the floor. And, like, the two of us end up working the mops that evening and then stand, like, 10 ips. But, yeah, you know, small price to pay for a chuckle. Another month goes by, and, you know, I move up to Unit 4 and then to 5. Where the resident goon was this, like, big blonde guy, like, almost like fucking Neanderthal, with this gnarly brow, like total Bond henchman. But it turns out, you know, he's pretty cool. The guy's studying like Russian lit at BYU, and he turns me on to Dr. Zhivago, Boris Pasternak. And I was loving it, you know, getting a little bit lost because everybody has like 5,000 different like surnames and nicknames, you know. You know, during the evenings when everyone else was winding down, you know, he and I just started having these conversations about like Dr. Zhivago and the Russian Revolution and like cool, interesting topics. And I remember at one point I just asked him, I say, you know, so you're Mormon. And he's like, yeah, I'm Mormon. And I'm like, well, tell me, like, what is it with you? I mean, not what is it with you people, but it's like, you know, what do you guys believe? Like, what's the deal? And I remember he told me, he was very open. And he wasn't proselytizing or anything like that. You know, he just gives me the cliff notes, you know? And I remember like kind of trying to paraphrase back to him to make sure I got it. I'm like, okay, so there's a dude in upstate New York. He has a vision from some Moroni. It's like an Italian demigod or something. And the dude cruises out here in the desert, meets a lizard who leads into some box that has a book that has some gold tablets. And you guys can have as many wives as you want. That's cool. And you believe that you can kind of become like your own gods and create your own worlds. And he stops me. Yeah, something like that, but without the lizard. And I'm like, that's amazing. You know, it's like a fucking sci-fi movie. And he's all, yeah, it's cool. And it was cool. Like we had like this open adult, like intellectual conversation about it. Tuesday evenings, I go to gym. In the middle of the Provo compound, there's this sunken gymnasium with like super high ceilings and like units 3, 4, 5, and 6, like they can all look down inside the gym. And we play like what I call like ground hockey. Like there's no ice or skates, but you know, we got sticks and we chase after like a ball instead of a puck. And the goon who was the gym coach, who we called coach, was a Mormon from Sweden, from Stockholm. From Göteborg, sorry. And he was like 5'5" by 5'5". I mean, he was just a fucking box. The guy was just huge. His tits were massive. Just all muscle. You know, like Swedes in hockey, you know, they're just cold, like rough, tough people. And me, you know, I mean, like my dad was super athletic and he maybe passed some of that on to me. So I was a pretty decent soccer player. And I'm pretty competitive. I mean, my sister Bao, like she's an insane athlete. She's 1 year older than me. And I've never been like more equally balanced with like an opponent in my life. Like her and I, we played shit tons of like paddle court, which I believe nowadays everybody calls like pickleball. It's got like a same size court, but you don't play with a wiffle ball. You play with this really kind of spongy bouncy ball and these metal rackets with holes in them. And you can play it up off of a cage that surrounds the court. So it's kind of like, I guess, like more like squash meets tennis maybe, but with like different rackets and more rubbery balls. But we'd always go to three sets, and whoever lost would be like, let's go again, let's go again. So I got a lot of my competitiveness from my sister. But so, yeah, I mean, at Provo, you know, we're playing hockey and I'm getting pretty good at dribbling like around like coach's team. And he's funny. When I juke one of his guys, he'd swear in Swedish like,
"Ta pucken från grabbfan. Ta honom."
And one time I juke coach himself and that was it. It's like, you don't do that. And like that unleashes the Viking. And that's when the body checks came out. And he would body check the shit out of me. You know, it was like, boom. But, you know, it was all good fun. Couple times in a row, there might have been a bloody nose here and there. But, you know, man, it never felt abusive. It actually felt kind of cool. Because in a weird way with Coach, you know, I won't say it was a safe space, but it was a controlled space where you could get a little rough and express some of that anger, some of that angst. And it's all in the name of sport. And coach, like he kind of encouraged it, you know?
And so I body check him back, but it's like slamming into like a neutron star, just like dense mass. But then the rest of my team dives in and coach lets us all pile on top of him. And then with one move, he sends us all flying across the gym, you know. Laughter and bruises. But yeah, you know, good times. And so by now, you know, like, Provo has my id on a leash, you know. It's like, heel boy, heel! And as unnatural as it is for like a 17-year-old kid, there's like a certain serenity that comes when you've like transgressed all you can transgress. When there is no more trouble you can get into. And you just cease to struggle and just, you know, be. And it's weird because you don't see it coming. Like in the beginning, you know, you languish in anguish, but then subtly, you know, Father Time, like that dude's got like a fucking black belt in jiu-jitsu, you know? He just flips you on your back, and before you know it, you're just lying there, you know? And on the rare occasion, you find yourself happy. So I move up to Unit 5, where Friday nights, I'm assigned KP. It's kitchen duty. Which puts me elbow deep in some industrial sink, you know, scraping a lasagna pan. And this is where I make friends with a guy named Wheeze, which is a fucking awesome nickname. And Wheeze, he's this kind of like alternative goth dude who, like rumor has it, could easily be hotel by now. But for some reason, like he stopped advancing a while ago, like sort of like Oscar from the Tin Drum, without like the high-pitched scream. So Wheeze and I, like, we have French together, and his French is, like, way better than mine. He'd actually spent a summer out there, and so during KP, he's always going on about, like, how rad French chicks are and stuff. And at the end of our shift on Friday nights, like, hotel kids show up to Café Cynique to have their coveted, you know, pizza party.
Pizza! Pizza party!
And fucking Chet, you know, he'd made hotel, like, a week or so back. You know, he's there making a show of eating the pizza, you know, like it's fucking nectar from the gods or something. Reminding Wheeze and me, you know, that pizza night's the private reserve of hotel royalty. You know, not for peasants like us. But fucking Wheeze, like, he looks around making sure the coast is clear, like no goons are watching. And then he minds, like, ejaculating onto Chet's pizza slice. Yeah. Fucking Wheeze is so rad. So after the party, the Grimace volunteers two hotel kids to stay behind and, like, break down the pizza boxes while Wheeze and I, you know, we mop the floors. And tonight, the Grimace volunteers Chet and some other dude, who, to my surprise, donned these new red coats. So like, up until now, like, you know, we all wore these, like, just standard-issue blue coats. But, yeah, not any longer, I suppose. And I don't make too much out of it, you know. It seems like, you know, just another subtle trick to reinforce, like, the psychology, you know, like, suppress the id and Polly gets a cracker. Like, I don't know. Wheeze, like, he's impervious to all this. But, I don't know, inside of me there's this budding notion, wouldn't it be nice, you know, to have a slice of cheese and a fine red coat? So Wheeze has, like, this killer tape collection. You know, he's from, like, Los Angeles and, like, listens to K-Rock, you know, like, Rodney on the Rock. And he's always turning me on to, like, you know, this really cool music, you know? Like Nina Hagen.
This is, again, Radio Yerevan with our music.
And, like, one night, I remember he hands me this cassette, and he's like, dude, you gotta check this out. This is Tones on Tail. They're super rad. And I'm like, right on, man. You know, I got some new music to check out. And it's Friday night, which means you've got mail. First letter's from Dad. I've been writing to him pretty regularly, you know, pretending that everything's hunky-dory. I'm loving this place, you know. Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far. But, you know, in general, like, trying to convey, like, a new kind of tamed attitude. And, like, I don't even know why I do it. But yeah, I've long abandoned any hope that, like, he's going to spring me from this fucking shithole. Rather, just feeding the meter. Maybe he'll send me some fresh batteries for my Walkman. I don't know. Next letter's from Mom.
she sold the house and has moved to San Diego. And that was a blow, I must admit. And I kind of felt like ripped out by the roots. You know, the sound room, my drums, my posters, my records, like I would never see any of those again. But I love my mom. You know, we're very close. We have a very beautiful and special relationship, you know, just grounded on just full-blown mutual respect and understanding. You know, my mom's bookcase, there was this pop psychology book from the 70s. It's called, like, I'm Okay, You're Okay. The guy, Harris, I think is his name. You know, he writes about, like, transactional analysis as it relates to, like, the dynamics of relationships and shit. And I actually read it a few years back. Really cool. But my mom and I, we used to say, you know, like, together, like, I'm okay, you're okay. You know, live and let live. You know, forgiveness is grace, respect. So, I don't know. I guess I'm a mama's boy. My mama's boy. I get a letter from Matt. Last weekend, you know, everybody spent the night in Santa Cruz, surf sesh at Pleasure Point. You know, some fucking locals hassled so-and-so. There was a kegger on the beach at Bonnie Dune, and so-and-so was frying on mushrooms and singed his balls jumping over the bonfire. And it's just all too much. It's like, I don't know how to describe the sensation, but it was like this spiky liquid-like sensation just kind of fills my stomach. And it's the sadness, you know, the asymmetry of it all. Like their lives, all my friends, you know, raging in full teenage glory, juxtaposed with me, you know, just wasting away here in Provo Canyon. One letter I save for the last. It's from a girl who I've had a crush on, but you know, we're just friends. But yeah, we've been corresponding a lot. I try to write something interesting each time, you know, try to keep things going, but like, I don't have much to say. I mean, like, hey, what can I say? I mean, like, hey, you know, I made a circle with my fingers on my thigh and Tommy didn't notice it, so I got to punch him. And I got sent down to investment where I stood for an hour staring at a wall, you know? Riveting stuff. But yeah, you know, she writes that her parents are taking her to Europe this summer. And the sadness, you know, it swirls and curdles and just fucking turns rancid, you know? I feel like even farther away. So like her letter, I read it over and over, but I never feel better. I just end up feeling more and more, like, removed. Like, out of it. And, you know, I try to shake it off, but like, the sadness, like, just fucking sticks to the soul. So, you know, my life goes on. I just grin and bear it, you know, toil on, you know, scraping lasagna, bouncing quarters off bed sheets, you know, pushing my boulder up the mountain. Just trying my best to, you know, love the slope.
Next time on Escape from Provo Canyon.
Joe and John and Bernie, you know, they're going to jam out. What? Rock and roll? What the fuck? And the curtains part, I just click us in.